Welcome to Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Howard's End. E.M. Forster's masterpiece will transport you to turn of the 20th century England, where three families intertwine at a moment in history where industrial progress threatens traditional pastoral life. From the idealistic and cultured Schlegel sisters, the pragmatic Wilcoxes, to the struggling Bests, Marilyn captures them all en route to finding out their fates and that of the iconic house called Howard's End. This is the latest title in our podcast series, Marilyn Lightstone Reads. If this is your first time with us, you can find all the other novels plus new episodes at classicalfm.ca or through your favorite podcast app. Now, let's turn to Marilyn as she reads Howard's End.
Chapter 33. The day of her visit was exquisite, and the last of unclouded happiness that she was to have for many months. Her anxiety about Helen's extraordinary absence was still dormant, and as for a possible brush with Miss Avery, that only gave zest to the expedition. She had also eluded Dolly's invitation to luncheon. Walking straight up from the station, she crossed the village green and entered the long chestnut avenue that connects it with the church. The church itself stood in the village once, but it there attracted so many worshippers that the devil, in a pet, snatched it from its foundations and poised it on an inconvenient knoll 3/4 of a mile away. If this story is true, the Chestnut Avenue must have been planted by the angels. No more tempting approach could be imagined for the lukewarm Christian, and if he still finds the walk too long, the devil is defeated all the same. Science, having built Holy Trinity, a chapel of ease, near the Charleses, and roofed it with tin. Up the avenue, Margaret strolled slowly, stopping to watch the sky that gleamed through the upper branches of the chestnuts, or to finger the little horseshoes on the lower branches. Why has not England a great mythology? Our folklore has never advanced beyond daintiness, and the greater melodies about our countryside have all issued through the pipes of Greece. Deep and true as the native imagination can be, it seems to have failed here. It has stopped with the witches and the fairies. It cannot vivify one fraction of a summer field, or give names to half a dozen stars. England still waits for the supreme moment of her literature, for the great poet who shall voice her, or better still, for the thousand little poets whose voices shall pass into our common talk. At the church, the scenery changed. The Chestnut Avenue opened into a road, smooth but narrow, which led into the untouched country. She followed it for over a mile. Its little hesitations pleased her. Having no urgent destiny, it strolled downhill or up as it wished, taking no trouble about the gradients nor about the view, which nevertheless expanded. The great estates that throttle the south of Herefordshire were less obtrusive here, and the appearance of the land was neither aristocratic nor suburban. To define it was difficult, but Margaret knew what it was not. It was not snobbish. Though its contours were slight, there was a touch of freedom in their sweep to which Surrey will never attain, and the distant brow of the Chilterns towered like a mountain. Left to itself, was Margaret's opinion, this county would vote Liberal. The comradeship, not passionate, that is our highest gift as a nation, was promised by it, as by the low brick farm where she called for the key. But the inside of the farm was disappointing. A most finished young person received her.
Yes, Mrs. Wilcox. No, Mrs. Wilcox. Oh, yes, Mrs. Wilcox. Auntie received your letter quite duly. Auntie has gone up to your little place at the present moment. Shall I send the servant to direct you?
Followed by,
of course, Auntie does not generally look after your place. She only does it to oblige a neighbour as something exceptional. It gives her something to do. She spends quite a lot of her time there. My husband says to me sometimes, where's Auntie? I say, need you ask? She's at Howard's End. Oh, yes, Mrs. Wilcox. Mrs. Wilcox, could I prevail upon you to accept a piece of cake? Not if I cut it for you.
Margaret refused the cake.
But unfortunately, this acquired her gentility in the eyes of Miss Avery's niece.
"I cannot let you go on alone. Now, don't. You really mustn't. I will direct you myself if it comes to that. I must get my hat. Now," roguishly. "Mrs. Wilcox, don't you move while I'm gone."
Stunned, Margaret did not move from the best parlor, over which the touch of Art Nouveau had fallen. But the other rooms looked in keeping, though they conveyed the peculiar sadness of a rural interior. Here had lived an elder race, to which we look back with disquietude. The country which we visit at weekends was really a home to it, and the graver sides of life, the deaths, the partings, the yearnings for love, have their deepest expression in the heart of the fields. All was not sadness. The sun was shining without. The thrush sang his two syllables on the budding guelder rose. Some children were playing uproariously in heaps of golden straw. It was the presence of sadness at all that surprised Margaret, and ended by giving her a feeling of completeness. In these English farms, if anywhere, one might see life steadily and see it whole. But her thoughts were interrupted by the return of Miss Avery's niece, and were so tranquilizing that she suffered the interruption gladly. It was quicker to go out by the back door, and after due explanations, they went out by it. The niece was now mortified by innumerable chickens who rushed up to her feet for food, and by a shameless and maternal sow. She did not know what animals were coming to, but her gentility withered at the touch of the sweet air. The wind was rising, scattering the straw and ruffling the tails of the ducks as they floated in families over Evie's pendant. One of those delicious gales of spring, in which leaves stiff in bud seemed to rustle, swept over the land, and then fell silent.
"Georgie," sang the thrush.
"Cuckoo," came furtively from the cliff of pine trees.
"Georgia, pretty Georgia,"
and the other birds joined in with nonsense. The hedge was a half-painted picture which would be finished in a few days. Celandines grew on its banks, lords and ladies and primroses in the defended hollows. The wild rose bushes, still bearing their withered hips, showed also the promise of blossom. Spring had come, clad in no classical garb, yet fairer than all springs, fairer even than she who walks through the myrtles of Tuscany with the graces before her and the zephyr behind. The two women walked up the lane full of outward civility. But Margaret was thinking how difficult it was to be earnest about furniture on such a day, and the niece was thinking about hats. Thus engaged, they reached Howard's End.
Petulant cries of, "Auntie!"
severed the air. There was no reply, and the front door was locked.
"Are you sure that Miss Avery is up here?"
asked Margaret.
"Oh, yes, Mrs. Wilcox, quite sure. She is here daily."
Margaret tried to look in through the dining-room window, but the curtain inside was drawn tightly. So with the drawing-room and the hall. The appearance of these curtains was familiar, yet she did not remember them being there on her other visit. Her impression was that Mr. Bryce had taken everything away. They tried the back. Here again they received no answer, and could see nothing. The kitchen window was fitted with a blind, while the pantry and scullery had pieces of wood propped up against them, which looked ominously like the lids of packing cases. Margaret thought of her books, and she lifted up her voice also. At the first cry, she succeeded.
"Well, well," replied someone inside the house, "if it isn't Mrs. Wilcox come at last." "Have you got the key, Auntie?" "Madge, go away,"
said Miss Avery, still invisible.
"Auntie, it's Mrs. Wilcox,"
Margaret supported her.
"Your niece and I have come together. Madge, go away. This is no moment for your hat."
The poor woman went red. "Auntie gets more eccentric lately," she said nervously.
"Miss Avery,"
called Margaret,
"I have come about the furniture. Could you kindly let me in?" "Yes, Mrs. Wilcox," said the voice. "Of course."
But after that came silence. They called again without response. They walked round the house disconsolately. I hope Miss Avery is not ill, hazarded Margaret.
Well, if you'll excuse me, said Madge, perhaps I ought to be leaving you now. The servants need seeing to at the farm. Auntie is so odd at times.
Gathering up her elegancies, she retired, defeated, and as if her departure had loosed a spring, the front door opened at once. Miss Avery said,
"Well, come right in, Mrs. Wilcox,"
quite pleasantly and calmly.
"Thank you so much,"
began Margaret, but broke off at the sight of an umbrella stand. It was her own.
"Come right into the hall first," said Miss Avery.
She drew the curtain, and Margaret uttered a cry of despair, for an appalling thing had happened. The hall was fitted up with the contents of the library from Wickham Place. The carpet had been laid, the big work-table drawn up near the window, the bookcases filled the wall opposite the fireplace, and her father's sword, this is what bewildered her particularly, had been drawn from its scabbard and hung naked amongst the sober volumes. Miss Avery must have worked for days.
"I'm afraid this isn't what we meant," she began. "Mr. Wilcox and I never intended the cases to be touched. For instance, these books are my brother's. We are storing them for him and for my sister, who is abroad. When you kindly undertook to look after things, we never expected you to do so much."
"The house has been empty long enough," said the old woman.
Margaret refused to argue.
"I dare say we didn't explain," she said civilly. "It has been a mistake, and very likely our mistake. Mrs. Wilcox, it has been mistake upon mistake for 50 years. The house is Mrs. Wilcox's, and she would not desire it to stand empty any longer."
To help the poor decaying brain, Margaret said,
"Yes, Mrs. Wilcox's house, the mother of Mr. Charles." "Mistake upon mistake," said Miss Avery. "Mistake upon mistake." "Well, I don't know," said Margaret, sitting down in one of her own chairs. "I really don't know what's to be done."
She could not help laughing.
The other said, "Yes, it should be a merry house enough." "I don't know, I dare say. Well, thank you very much, Miss Avery. Yes, it's all right. Delightful. There is still the parlour."
She went through the door opposite and drew a curtain. Light flooded the drawing room and the drawing room furniture from Wickham Place.
"And the dining room."
More curtains were drawn, more windows were flung open to the spring.
"Then through here,"
Miss Avery continued, passing and repassing through the hall. Her voice was lost, but Margaret heard her pulling up the kitchen blind.
"I've not finished here yet," she announced, returning. "There's still a great deal to do. The farm lads will carry your great wardrobes upstairs, for there is no need to go into expense at Hilton."
"It is all a mistake," repeated Margaret, feeling that she must put her foot down.
"A misunderstanding. Mr. Wilcox and I are not going to live at Howards End." "Oh, indeed, on account of his hay fever?"
"We have settled to build a new home for ourselves in Sussex, and part of this furniture, my part, will go down there presently."
She looked at Miss Avery intently, trying to understand the kink in her brain. Here was no maundering old woman. Her wrinkles were shrewd and humorous. She looked capable of scathing wit and also of high but unostentatious nobility.
"You think that you won't come back to live here, Mrs. Wilcox, but you will."
"That remains to be seen," said Margaret, smiling. "We have no intention of doing so for the present. We happen to need a much larger house. Circumstances oblige us to give big parties. Of course, some day." "Well, one never knows, does one?"
Miss Avery retorted.
"Some day? Oh, cha-cha-cha-cha. Don't talk about some day. You are living here now."
"Am I?"
"You are living here, and have been for the last 10 minutes, if you ask me."
It was a senseless remark, but with a queer feeling of disloyalty, Margaret rose from her chair. She felt that Henry had been obscurely censured. They went into the dining room, where the sunlight poured in upon her mother's chiffonier, and upstairs, where many an old god peeped from a new niche.
The furniture fitted extraordinarily well. In the central room, over the hall, the room that Helen had slept in 4 years ago, Miss Avery had placed Tibby's old bassinet.
"The nursery," she said.
Margaret turned away without speaking. At last, everything was seen. The kitchen and lobby were still stacked with furniture and straw, but as far as she could make out, nothing had been broken or scratched. A pathetic display of ingenuity. Then they took a friendly stroll in the garden. It had gone wild since her last visit. The gravel sweep was weedy, and grass had sprung up at the very jaws of the garage. And Evie's rockery was only bumps. Perhaps Evie was responsible for Miss Avery's oddness, but Margaret suspected that the cause lay deeper, and that the girl's silly letter had but loosed the irritation of years. "It's a beautiful meadow," she remarked. It was one of those open-air drawing rooms that had been formed hundreds of years ago out of the smaller fields. So the boundary hedge zigzagged down the hill at right angles, and at the bottom there was a little green annex, a sort of powder closet for the cows.
"Yes, the maid is well enough," said Miss Avery, "for those, that is, who don't suffer from sneezing." And she cackled maliciously. "I've seen Charles Wilcox go out to my lads in haytime. Oh, they ought to do this. They mustn't do that. He'd learn them to be lads." And just then the tickling took him. "He has it from his father, with other things. There's not one Wilcox that can stand up against a field in June." "I laughed fit to burst while he was courting Ruth." "My brother gets hay fever too," said Margaret. "His house lies too much on the land for them. Naturally, they were glad enough to slip in at first. But Wilcoxes are better than nothing, as I see you found." Margaret laughed. "They keep a place going, don't they? Yes, it is just that. They keep England going, it is my opinion." But Miss Avery upset her by replying, "Aye, they breed like rabbits. Well, it's a funny world. But he who made it knows what he wants in it. I suppose if Mrs. Charlie is expecting her fourth, it isn't for us to repine." "They breed and they also work," said Margaret, conscious of some invitation to disloyalty, which was echoed by the very breeze and by the songs of the birds. "It certainly is a funny world, but so long as men like my husband and his sons govern it, I think it'll never be a bad one. Never really bad."
"No, better than nothing," said Miss Avery, and turned to the witch elm.
On their way back to the farm, she spoke of her old friend much more clearly than before. In the house, Margaret had wondered whether she quite distinguished the first wife from the second. Now she said,
"I never saw much of Ruth after her grandmother died, but we stayed civil. It was a very civil family. Old Mrs. Howard never spoke against anybody, nor let anyone be turned away without food. Then it was never 'trespassers will be prosecuted' in their land, but 'would people please, please not come in.' Mrs. Howard was never created to run a farm."
"Had they no men to help them?" Margaret asked. Miss Avery replied,
"Things went on until there were no men."
"Until Mr. Wilcox came along," corrected Margaret, anxious that her husband should receive his due.
"I suppose so. But Ruth should have married a... No disrespect to you to say this, for I take it you were intended to get Wilcox anyway, whether she got him first or no."
"Whom should she have married?"
"A soldier," exclaimed the old woman. "Some real soldier."
Margaret was silent. It was a criticism of Henry's character far more trenchant than any of her own. She felt dissatisfied.
"But that's all over," she went on. "A better time is coming now, though you've kept me long enough waiting. In a couple of weeks I'll see your lights shining through the hedge of an evening. Have you ordered in coals?"
"We are not coming," said Margaret firmly. She respected Miss Avery too much to humour her. "No, not coming.
Never coming. It has all been a mistake. The furniture must be repacked at once, and I am very sorry, but I am making other arrangements and must ask you to give me the keys.
Oh, certainly, Mrs. Wilcox, said Miss Avery,
and resigned her duties with a smile. Relieved at this conclusion, and having sent her compliments to Madge, Margaret walked back to the station. She had intended to go to the furniture warehouse and give directions for removal, but the muddle had turned out more extensive than she expected, so she decided to consult Henry. It was as well that she did this. He was strongly against employing the local man whom he had previously recommended and advised her to store in London after all. But before this could be done, an unexpected trouble fell upon her. Chapter 34. It was not unexpected entirely. Aunt Julie's health had been bad all the winter. She had had a long series of colds and coughs and had been too busy to get rid of them. She had scarcely promised her niece to really take my tiresome chest in hand when she caught a chill and developed acute pneumonia. Margaret and Tibby went down to Swanage. Helen was telegraphed for, and that spring party that after all gathered in that hospitable house had all the pathos of fair memories. On a perfect day, when the sky seemed blue porcelain and the waves of the discreet little bay beat gentlest of tattoos upon the sand, Margaret hurried up through the rhododendrons, confronted again by the senselessness of death. One death may explain itself, but it throws no light upon another. The groping inquiry must begin anew. Preachers or scientists may generalize, but we know that no generality is possible about those whom we love. Not one heaven awaits them, not even one oblivion. Aunt Julie, incapable of tragedy, slipped out of life with odd little laughs and apologies for having stopped in it so long. She was very weak. She could not rise to the occasion or realize the great mystery which all agree must await her. It only seemed to her that she was quite done up, more done up than ever before, that she saw and heard and felt less every moment, and that unless something changed, she would soon feel nothing. Her spare strength she devoted to plans. Could not Margaret take some steamer expeditions? Were mackerel cooked as Tibby like them? She worried herself about Helen's absence, and also that she could be the cause of Helen's return. The nurses seemed to think such interests quite natural, and perhaps hers was an average approach to the great gate. But Margaret saw death stripped of any false romance. Whatever the idea of death may contain, the process can be trivial and hideous. Important, Margaret, dear. Take the Lulworth when Helen comes. Helen won't be able to stop, Aunt Julie. She has telegraphed that she can only get away just to see you. She must go back to Germany as soon as you are well.
Oh, how very odd of Helen. Mr. Wilcox.
Yes, dear.
Can he spare you?
Henry wished her to come, and had been very kind. Yet again, Margaret said so. Mrs. Munt did not die. Quite outside her will, a more dignified power took hold of her and checked her on the downward slope. She returned, without emotion, as fidgety as ever. On the fourth day, she was out of danger.
Margaret, important,
it went on.
I should like you to have some companion to take walks with. Do try Miss Conder.
I have been a little walk with Miss Conder,
but she is not really interesting. If only you had Helen.
I have Tibby, Aunt Julie.
No, but he has to do his Chinese. Some real companion is what you need. Really, Helen is odd.
Helen is odd, very, agreed Margaret.
Not content with going abroad, why does she want to go back there at once?
No doubt she will change her mind when she sees us. She has not the least balance. That was the stock criticism about Helen, but Margaret's voice trembled as she made it.
By now, she was deeply pained at her sister's behavior. It may be unbalanced to fly out of England, but to stop away 8 months argues that the heart is awry as well as the head. A sickbed could recall Helen, but she was deaf to more human calls. After a glimpse at her aunt, she would retire into her nebulous life behind some post-restaurant. She scarcely existed. Her letters had become dull and infrequent. She had no wants and no curiosity, and it was all put down to poor Henry's account. Henry, long pardoned by his wife, was still too infamous to be greeted by his sister-in-law. It was morbid, and to her alarm, Margaret fancied that she could trace the growth of morbidity back in Helen's life for nearly 4 years. The flight from Honiton, the unbalanced patronage of the Basts, the explosion of grief up on the Downs, all connected with Paul. An insignificant boy whose lips had kissed hers for a fraction of time. Margaret and Mrs. Wilcox had feared that they might kiss again. Foolishly, the real danger was reaction. Reaction against the Wilcoxes had eaten into her life until she was scarcely sane. At 25, she had an idée fixe. What hope was there for her as an old woman? The more Margaret thought about it, the more alarmed she became. For many months she had put the subject away, but it was too big to be slighted now. There was almost a taint of madness. Were all Helen's actions to be governed by a tiny mishap, such as may happen to any young man or woman? Can human nature be constructed on lines so insignificant? The blundering little encounter at Howards End was vital. It propagated itself where graver intercourse lay barren. It was stronger than sisterly intimacy, stronger than reason or books. In one of her moods, Helen had convinced that she still enjoyed it in a certain sense. Paul had faded, but the magic of his caress endured. And where there is enjoyment of the past, there may also be a reaction, propagation at both ends. Well, it is odd and sad that our minds should be such seed beds, and we without power to choose the seed. But man is an odd, sad creature as yet, intent on pilfering the earth and heedless of the growths within himself. He cannot be bored about psychology. He leaves it to the specialist, which is as if he should leave his dinner to be eaten by a steam engine. He cannot be bothered to digest his own soul. Margaret and Helen have been more patient, and it is suggested that Margaret had succeeded, so far as success is yet possible. She does understand herself. She has some rudimentary control over her own growth. Whether Helen has succeeded, one cannot say. The day that Mrs. Munt rallied, Helen's letter arrived. She had posted it at Munich and would be in London herself on the morrow. It was a disquieting letter, though the opening was affectionate and sane.
Dearest Meg, give Helen's love to Aunt Julie. Tell her that I love and have loved her ever since I can remember. I shall be in London Thursday. My address will be care of the bankers. I've not yet settled on a hotel, so write or wire to me there and give me detailed news. If Aunt Julie is much better, or if, for a terrible reason, it would be no good my coming down to Swanage, you must not think it odd if I do not come. I have all sorts of plans in my head. I am living abroad at present and want to get back as quickly as possible. Will you please tell me where our furniture is? I should like to take out one or two books. The rest are for you. Forgive me, dearest Meg. This must read like rather a tiresome letter. But all letters are from your loving, Helen.
It was a tiresome letter, for it tempted Margaret to tell a lie. If she wrote that Aunt Julie was still in danger, her sister would come. Unhealthiness is contagious. We cannot be in contact with those who are in a morbid state without ourselves deteriorating. To act for the best might do Helen good, but would do herself harm. And at the risk of disaster, she kept her colors flying a little longer. She replied that their aunt was much better and awaited developments. Tibby approved of her reply. Mellowing rapidly, he was a pleasanter companion than before. Oxford had done much for him. He had lost his peevishness and could hide his indifference to people and his interest in food. But he had not grown more human. The years between 18 and 22, so magical for most, were leading him gently from boyhood to middle age. He had never known young manliness, that quality which warms the heart till death and gives Mr. Wilcox an imperishable charm. He was frigid, through no fault of his own, and without cruelty. He thought Helen wrong and Margaret right, but the family trouble was for him what a scene behind footlights is for most people. He had only one suggestion to make, and that was characteristic. "Why don't you tell Mr. Wilcox?" "About Helen? Perhaps he has come across that sort of thing." "He would do all he could, but—" "Oh, you know best. But he is practical." It was the student's belief in experts. Margaret demurred for one or two reasons. Presently, Helen's answer came. She sent a telegram requesting the address of the furniture, as she would now return at once. Margaret replied, "Certainly not. Meet me at the banker's at 4. She and Tibby went up to London. Helen was not at the banker's, and they were refused her address. Helen had passed into chaos. Margaret put her arm round her brother. He was all that she had left, and never had he seemed more insubstantial. "Tibby, love, what next?" He replied, "It is extraordinary." "Dear, your judgment's often clearer than mine. Have you any notion what's at the back?"
"None, unless it's something mental."
"Oh, that," said Margaret, "quite impossible." But the suggestion had been uttered, and in a few minutes she took it up herself. Nothing else explained, and London agreed with Tibby. The mask fell off the city, and she saw it for what it really is, a caricature of infinity. The familiar barriers, the streets along which she moved, the houses between which she had made her little journeys for so many years, became negligible suddenly. Helen seemed one with grimy trees and the traffic and the slowly flowing slabs of mud. She had accomplished a hideous act of renunciation and returned to the One. Margaret's own faith held firm. She knew the human soul will be merged, if it be merged at all, with the stars and the sea. Yet she felt that her sister had been going amiss for many years. It was symbolic the catastrophe should come now, on a London afternoon, while rain fell slowly. Henry was the only hope. Henry was definite. He might know of some paths in the chaos that were hidden from them, and she determined to take Tibby's advice and lay the whole matter in his hands. They must call at his office. He could not well make it worse. She went for a few minutes into St. Paul's, whose dome stands out of the welter so bravely, as if preaching the gospel of form. But within, St. Paul's is as its surroundings, echoes and whispers, inaudible songs, invisible mosaics, wet footmarks crossing and recrossing the floor. Henry was unsatisfactory at first. That she had expected. He was overjoyed to see her back from Swanage, and slow to admit the growth of a new trouble. When they told him of their search, he only chaffed Tibby and the Schlegels generally, and declared that it was just like Helen to lead her relatives a dance.
"That is what we all say," replied Margaret. "But why should it be just like Helen? Why should she be allowed to be so queer and to grow queerer?"
"Don't ask me. I'm a plain man of business. I live and let live. My advice to you both is, don't worry. Margaret, you've got black marks again under your eyes. You know that's strictly forbidden. First your aunt, then your sister. No, we aren't going to have it. Are we, Theobald?" He rang the bell. "I'll give you some tea, and then you go straight to Ducie Street. I can't have my girl looking as old as her husband."
"All the same, you've not quite seen our point," said Tibby.
Mr. Wilcox, who was in good spirits, retorted, "I don't suppose I ever shall." He leaned back, laughing at the gifted but ridiculous family, while the fire flickered over the map of Africa. Margaret motioned to her brother to go on. Rather diffident, he obeyed her.
"Margaret's point is this," he said. "Our sister may be mad."
Charles, who was working in the inner room, looked round.
"Come in, Charles," said Margaret kindly. "Could you help us at all? We are again in trouble."
"I'm afraid I cannot. What are the facts? We are all mad, more or less, you know, in these days."
"The facts are as follows," replied Tibby, who had at times a pedantic lucidity. "The facts are that she has been in England for 3 days and will not see us. She has forbidden the bankers to give us her address. She refuses to answer questions. Margaret finds her letters colourless. There are other facts, but these are the most striking."
"She has never behaved like this before, then?" asked Henry.
"Of course not," said his wife, with a frown. "Well, my dear, how am I to know?"
A senseless spasm of annoyance came over her. "You know quite well that Helen never sins against affection," she said. "You must have noticed that much in her, surely?"
"Oh, yes. She and I have always hit it off together."
"No, Henry. Can't you see? I don't mean that."
She recovered herself, but not before Charles had observed her. Stupid and attentive, he was watching the scene.
"I was meaning that when she was eccentric in the past, one could trace it back to the heart in the long run. She behaved oddly because she cared for someone or wanted to help them. There's no possible excuse for her now. She is grieving us deeply, and that is why I am sure that she is not well."
"Mad is too terrible a word, but she is not well. I shall never believe it. I shouldn't discuss my sister with you if I thought she was well. Trouble you about her, I mean."
Henry began to grow serious. Ill health was to him something perfectly definite. Generally well himself, he could not realize that we sink to it by slow gradations.
The sick had no rights. They were outside the pale. One could lie to them remorselessly. When his first wife was seized, he had promised to take her down into Herefordshire, but meanwhile arranged with a nursing home instead. Helen, too, was ill, and the plan that he sketched out for her capture, clever and well-meaning as it was, drew its ethics from the wolf pack.
"You want to get hold of her?" he said. "That's the problem, isn't it? She's got to see a doctor.
For all I know, she's seen one already."
"Yes, yes, yes. Don't interrupt."
He rose to his feet and thought intently. The genial, tentative host disappeared, and they saw instead the man who had carved money out of Greece and Africa and bought forests from the natives for a few bottles of gin.
"I've got it," he said at last. "It's perfectly easy. Leave it to me. We'll send her down to Howards End."
"How will you do that?"
"After her books. Tell her that she must unpack them herself. Then you can meet her there."
"But, Henry, that's just what she won't let me do. It's part of her, whatever it is, never to see me."
"Of course you won't tell her you're going. When she is there looking at the cases, you'll just stroll in. If nothing is wrong with her, so much the better. But there'll be the motor round the corner, and we can run her up to a specialist in no time."
Margaret shook her head.
"It's quite impossible."
"Why?"
"It doesn't seem impossible to me," said Tibby. "It is surely a very tippy plan."
"It is impossible because—"
She looked at her husband sadly.
"It's not the particular language that Helen and I talk, if you see my meaning. It would do splendidly for other people, whom I don't blame."
"But Helen doesn't talk," said Tibby. "That's our whole difficulty. She won't talk your particular language, and on that account you think she's ill."
"No, Henry, it's sweet of you, but I couldn't."
"I see," he said.
"You have scruples."
"I suppose so. And sooner than go against them, you would have your sister suffer. You could have got her down to Swanage by a word. But you had scruples, and scruples are all very well. I am as scrupulous as any man alive, I hope. But when it is a case like this, and there is a question of madness—"
"I deny it's madness. You
You said just now,
it's madness when I say it, but not when you say it.
Henry shrugged his shoulders.
Margaret. Margaret. No education can teach a woman logic. Now, my dear, my time is valuable. Do you want me to help you or not?
Not in that way.
Answer my question. Plain question, plain answer. Do...
Charles surprised them by interrupting.
Peter, we may as well keep Howards End out of it, he said.
Why, Charles? Charles could give no reason, but Margaret felt as if, over tremendous distance, a salutation had passed between them.
The whole house is sixes and sevens, he said crossly. We don't want any more mess.
Who's we? Asked his father.
My boy, pray, who's we?
I am sure I beg your pardon, said Charles. I appear always to be intruding.
By now, Margaret wished she had never mentioned her trouble to her husband. Retreat was impossible. He was determined to push the matter to a satisfactory conclusion, and Helen faded as he talked. Her fair, flying hair and eager eyes counted for nothing, for she was ill, without rights, and any of her friends might hunt her. Sick at heart, Margaret joined in the chase. She wrote her sister a lying letter at her husband's dictation. She said the furniture was all at Howards End, but could be seen on Monday next at 3 p.m., when a charwoman would be in attendance. It was a cold letter, and the more plausible for that. Helen would think she was offended, and on Monday next she and Henry were to lunch with Dolly, and then ambush themselves in the garden. After they had gone, Mr. Wilcox said to his son,
I can't have this sort of behaviour, my boy. Margaret's too sweet-natured to mind, but I mind for her.
Charles made no answer.
Is anything wrong with you, Charles, this afternoon?
No, Peter, but you may be taking on a bigger business than you reckon.
How? Don't ask me.
Thank you for listening to Marilyn Lightstone Reads Howards End. This episode was produced by Duncan Briggs. Executive producer Moses Neimer. This is the latest book in our podcast series, Marilyn Lightstone Reads. Other novels in the series include Sense and Sensibility, The Secret Garden, Anne of Green Gables, Pride and Prejudice, Vanity Fair, and Showboat. You can find them all at classicalfm.ca or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also help support this podcast by recommending it to your friends and leaving a 5-star review in your preferred podcast store. And while you're there, look for a variety of other quality podcasts proudly presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network.